This is the Knowledge Bandits Podcast. I'm your host, Arum. I'd like to thank you for joining us today. Let's start the show.
This is the Knowledge Bandits Podcast. I'm excited to bring you today's guest, Ms. Brahma Wright. Brahma is a social entrepreneur working to innovate the shea butter supply chain in West Africa. In 2005, she launched Shea Aline International, a nonprofit organization that supports women-owned cooperatives in West Africa and provides training on quality assurance and micro-enterprise development. With a vision to develop an integrative and sustainable supply chain, Brahma created Shea Aline Health and Beauty LLC in 2012, a for-profit sister organization. Shea Aline markets and distributes high-quality skincare products while providing living wages to cooperative members. Brahma's high-quality shea butter products are being distributed through Whole Foods markets. In 2014, she completed her first round of private equity investment with Pan African Investment Company. She currently serves as an advisor to entrepreneurs in the Johns Hopkins University Social Innovation Lab. In 2014, she was appointed to President Obama's Advisory Council on Doing Business in Africa.
So, Brahma, I've given a very brief introduction, but can you take time to let the bandits get to know you a little bit better?
Hi, bandits. I'm really excited to share my story and connect with you. My name is Brahma, as Arum said. I was born in northern Ghana, in Tamale, to be exact. That's where my mother's side of the family is from. But I grew up in upstate New York, outside of Syracuse, and that's where my dad's family is from.
Very good, very good. And so how did you come to starting your nonprofit and the business itself?
So I always knew I wanted to do work in Africa, largely because of the fact that my mom was from West Africa. So I was very fascinated with African-related issues from a very young age. But of course, I didn't know what I wanted to do exactly. But in high school, I decided I was going to follow my dad's footsteps and join the Peace Corps. And so after college, I was assigned to a community health clinic in a village that was about 2 hours outside of Bamako in Mali. And during that time, because I was familiar and when I was young, we traveled throughout West Africa, I wasn't really shocked like other volunteers in terms of not having access to running water or electricity or some of the issues around traveling and the roads. What really shocked me was the role of women in my village. And seeing that there were certain things that were preventing women from being able to be financially independent, being able to make certain choices in their lives. For example, there were girls in my community that weren't allowed to go to school because they were girls. And the community was largely a Muslim community and very conservative. And so the role of women and really experiencing the challenges and issues women had in my community really sparked this curiosity around, well, how do women generate money? How do women make money within these communities? And so I started a secondary project focused on researching income-generating activities for women. And a lot of the women in my community were farmers because it was an agriculturally-based community. And so I started learning about shea butter, its connection to the lives of women in my community. But as I delved deeper, I saw that there was a huge disconnect between women and the marketplace. And so women, although they're the traditional harvesters of shea, and shea only comes from sub-Saharan Africa, you can't find it anywhere else in the world, it's a tree, women who are the traditional producers don't have the opportunities, the production tools, the market connections, the market linkages to really generate living wages and a sustainable livelihood from this great product. And so that's what sparked, you know, this kind of obsession to figure out how to provide a solution, to figure out how to help connect the dots between local communities in West Africa and the marketplace when it comes to shea butter. So initially, I started Shea Aline as a 501c3 nonprofit. I was in my early 20s. I had no idea what I was doing. So bandits, I hope I give you some hope. If I can start a business, you surely can as well. I came back to the U.S. in 2005. I launched Shea Aline as a 501c3 nonprofit because I was really looking at it from the perspective of this being an issue around grassroots community development. So I thought the nonprofit model would be the best way to really solve this issue. And so I initially focused primarily on organizing cooperatives, providing training to the women, giving them access to production equipment, really building the capacity on the ground for women to make this product. And then I realized that I was only providing a partial solution. And so when I launched Shayaleen Health and Beauty in 2012, the real goal there was looking at the market piece, looking at the market linkage. And I also was interested in diversifying my sources of funding. As a young founder of a nonprofit, there really wasn't a lot of confidence in terms of getting huge grants. And, you know, it's really hard when you're first starting out. But I was starting to hear a lot around impact investing funding. And so I was really interested to see if my business model could be adapted to be attractive to impact investors. And so I launched Shayaleen Health and Beauty with the primary role of bringing high quality Shea products to the U.S. market, as well as diversifying my sources of funding and leveraging and benefiting from impact investing.
Wow, that's really interesting. You gave sort of a lot of information, and I'm definitely sure there's some bandits who are sort of struggling on whether to start their nonprofit or whether to register as an LLC, but I'm sure they'll be able to connect with you through this podcast and learn a little bit more about that. A few things that you mentioned that I thought were worth noting. So you mentioned sort of the link between the nonprofit world and also the private sector, starting your own business. Currently, I'm reading a book called A Fortune at the Bottom of the Pyramid, and it's talking about this idea of creative capitalism on how nonprofits have really mastered how to solve the social issues and businesses have mastered how to make money, essentially, and provide better living standards for people. But can you talk a little bit about how you think moving into the future, Africans starting their businesses can merge these two and sort of have a different model of what capitalism is?
Absolutely. I think we often hear about companies creating socially corporate responsible initiatives within their strategies. And so corporate social responsibility has become really popular. And my perspective is that businesses should be socially responsible, period. It should not be a division. It should be a value that is integrated throughout all areas of a business model. And I've come to believe that businesses are truly the real solutions to long-term change to some of the challenges and problems that we're seeing throughout the continent. We need businesses that are socially conscious. We need businesses that are looking at innovative solutions to address high levels of poverty, to address issues of inequality, to address issues of gender and incorporating gender within business development. And starting an organization initially coming from this nonprofit perspective, I've really adapted the way that I have done my model and the way that I've been thinking about this to become more of a social enterprise that has a very strong business component. And to all the bandits out there who are really struggling with trying to figure out where they fall in all of this, my advice would be create a model, create a business model that can be sustainable, that will be sustainable. Really look at, even if you start out with grants or even if you start out with looking at just being a nonprofit, think creatively about how your nonprofit can sustain itself.
I think that's really great advice. I definitely appreciate that. I'm going to use that for myself, and I'm sure the bandits will also take heed to that advice. And earlier on, you mentioned a little bit about going about raising money for your business. So I just want to know, when you first started, was it bootstrapped? And if you ever raised money after that, can you talk a little bit more about how it evolved into something much larger than just your bank account?
Yes. Well, I call myself the 10-year overnight success because it really did take, 7 years really before I had a business idea and a model that I could really figure out how to scale. So within those first 7 years, I was bootstrapping. I was the queen of bootstrapping. I mean, I would negotiate to a penny because I was paying for everything out of pocket. And I was working multiple jobs to accomplish that. I mean, when I came back from Peace Corps, I had no real career experience or professional experience. I was volunteering for 2 years and I had no money because I went straight from college to doing volunteering. And so I really had to leverage family, friends, and I had to work. I worked multiple jobs. I did everything from waitressing to working at PR events, like, you know, anything that I could to get a little bit more money to invest in my idea. So that was the greater part of 7 years. And that was also when I was exclusively a nonprofit. And so I really was starting to burn out, to be quite honest. That's not a model that you can sustain or really scale. And so that's when I started looking at private equity, looking at impact investing. I created a business plan. I created a pitch deck. And I just started contacting people, some cold calls, and just started seeing if I could get someone to accept a meeting, and then I would pitch. And one of the things that I've learned is getting access to funding is all about relationships. So Bandits, you have to invest in building relationships, because someone who's going to write a check and someone who's going to give you money, there has to be a level of trust and there has to be a level of confidence that your business is something that is worth their time and worth their money. And so I was fortunate enough to leverage a relationship and was connected to the CEO of the Pan-African Investment Fund and pitched. She loved the idea. And it was actually coincidentally around the same time that two of our shea producers from Ghana were in the U.S. and they were visiting Whole Foods stores with me. And so we also got a chance to pitch to the fund. They loved it. They heard from the women. And then there was an 8-month due diligence process of, you know, looking at my projections, looking at my financials, looking at the strategy, the marketing, all of that. So you build that in. It's not something that will happen overnight. From the intro to actually getting funding was an 8-month process.
Wow. And I think that's something, it's sort of really great advice. You said it's all about relationships. I think a lot of times as we are entrepreneurs first stepping out with our first ideas, we have this sort of unrelenting passion for it. And we expect other people to sort of have that same passion, but it never really happens that way. So it's being able to articulate that passion through crafting a great business plan, through crafting materials that people can look at and see, wow, this person is actually really invested in this project. And I think, again, just it's important to reiterate, it's all about relationships. So when you're networking with people, it's not only finding what they can do for you, but also how you can help them. That improves the overall relationship and essentially gives you the best out of networking. And I want to ask a little bit about what scale you're operating at, because I mean, I was reading up on Shea Yaleen and I see that you're in several Whole Foods stores and it looks like you're doing a lot of good work. So can you talk about sort of what your team is like on the US side and your team abroad in Africa?
Yeah, well, now we are in 123 retail locations, mostly on the East Coast of the U.S. So in places like New York, Boston, the Washington, D.C. area. And that really was a very grassroots push, because I don't think a lot of people know that Whole Foods is a very decentralized distribution model, which can be good when you're first starting out, because when we started, we launched in 7 stores and then we were able to grow. But we essentially had to grow almost door to door. And so we work with buyers at every single store. We're a direct vendor. And so it's very labor intensive. In Washington, D.C., we have 2 people working full time with me out of our D.C. office. And then I work with a variety of part timers, whether they're contractors or consultants that run their own firms, that run their own companies. So that could be the web person, the designer. We have sales brokers in every region that we have stores selling our products. We have demo reps, which are essentially brand ambassadors who are trained to provide samples at the stores. And so that's kind of essentially what we do in the U.S. is all the marketing and distribution of our products. Our office, which is very close to the Union Station Metro stop on 8th Street, also hosts events We do, you know, pop-ups. We've done some art pop-ups here. We've done a beauty day here. And it really has been very interesting because being here has given us more visibility. And, you know, people have walked in and I'm like, what's up here? And I also, you know, I think that's really important as you're growing your brand is to have a space where people can come to. So that's really what we're doing on the U.S. side. On the Ghana side, we partner directly with cooperatives. There are no intermediaries between Shailene and our cooperatives. We have an office in Tamale. We work with two cooperatives that have a membership of about 800 women. We have a bank account set up in Tamale. We have a financial manager, a coordinator, and a training manager who manage all of our activities on the ground. Last year, we built a black soap production facility in one of the villages that we work in, giving the community access to running water and electricity, and essentially all the infrastructure needed to create a product that we bring to market. In terms of the activities that we do on the ground, it's a combination of training. We invest heavily on training, providing access to production equipment, providing access to infrastructure, providing access to capital. And so the women, when they do a production run for us, we actually are in the process from start to end, meaning during the harvest season through production to getting the product on a ship to here. We are engaged in every single part of that process. Our model, and this is why I created Shailene, creating living wages for women who produce this product. I mean, I shared a little bit about my experience as a Peace Corps volunteer, and that's what ignited this. And we are able to help women increase their income by 5 times the Ghanaian minimum wage, which is just under $2. And so we increase, I'm trying to think of the translation. So it goes from 5 Ghana cedis to 35. And so it's like just under $2 to just over $8. So that gives you a sense of the financial impact on the ground. And we also provide health and access to health insurance. Wow. And so we work with our team to survey the women in the cooperatives, who has access to the Ghanaian health cards, who doesn't, and then making sure that, you know, they're brought to, you know, the center to fill out the form, you know, working with them on getting access to health services is really important. And then we can talk about, okay, we're helping these women increase their income, but what does that mean tangibly? It means that women are investing in sending their children to school. It means that women are investing in other income generating activities. It also means that women are investing in whether it's land ownership or upgrading their homes, in addition to, you know, all of their needs.
Wow, that's great. I think one of the biggest things for me is just this idea of creative capitalism and how you can have a business with the goal to make money, but also with the goal to help people. And it seems like from what you're doing, you're definitely working on increasing the standard of living for these people, which I think is definitely necessary as people from the diaspora are looking to start business in Africa. And so I just wanted to find out from you, starting a business where you sort of have basically no sort of bearings, how did you go about doing that? You weren't living in Ghana at the time. How were you able to navigate sort of the entire system? Because we hear over and over again how it's very difficult to get something started if you're not on the ground.
Absolutely. And I've been fortunate enough to build really, in the same way we're talking about the importance of relationships to getting access to funding, in order to run a business, you need to have the right team members. You need to be able to have trusting people on the ground that you're working together as partners. And so one of the things that I emphasize with my team members on the ground is that I have a role to play. I have a certain skill set. They have a role to play and they have a certain skill set as well. And the groups that we work with, I initially met the secretary of one of the cooperatives through the U.S. Embassy. They had invited me to do a program working with entrepreneurs in Ghana. And through that, I met a woman who was volunteering her time, had had been working on women's issues for a very long time and approached me and wanted to see if there was an opportunity to work together. And through that relationship, it wasn't like an immediate yes. We built a relationship, you know, and I tested it, you know, by doing small projects here and there, seeing how they worked, what didn't work, adjusting it, communication style. You know, someone can be really great, but if you don't know how to communicate with the other person, it's very difficult to build something that is sustainable. And what really got me was this person, her name is Joanna, was initially a volunteer. And seeing someone work hard as a volunteer is very demonstrative of their character, in my opinion, because I started my career as a volunteer. And so it's really finding commonalities and having the same value system, the same mission, the same ideas. Those are really important if you're working with partners and working with team members. With that, also understanding certain skill sets. So I'm bringing a certain skill set to the table. She's bringing a certain skill set to the table. You know, the women in this village, they're bringing a certain skill set, and recognizing everyone's role and the importance of each person's role. And that's one of the things that I emphasize with the groups that I work in. I'm not a Shea producer. I could be doing a million of other things. You know, that's what the value, the skill, the talent that they bring. What I can do, I can be a voice. I can, you know, I'm able to travel between the two countries. I'm able to market. I understand the U.S. market. I'm able to leverage relationships with retail and investors, et cetera. So, and being transparent is very important. So anyone who anyone in the diaspora who's interested in working in an African country, the very, very first thing is you have to spend time there. You cannot do it remotely. People have to see you. I do regularly 3 site visits a year. I've also had the women come here to do site visits here. And so all of that creates trust. And I think that that's the single most important thing when you're building a business, is the trust is so important when you're working with your team members and working with your partners. And we invest a lot, like I mentioned, in training. I have one-on-one meeting when I go. I just don't meet with like the leaders of the cooperative. I'll randomly meet with women one-on-one by myself with them, so they don't feel like they have to say a certain thing, you know, and just say, hey, what's going on? Talk to me. And I think that also another thing that's really important is whatever commitments that I make and whatever commitments that they make is openly shared with everyone. So there's accountability. And I think that one of the things I've seen a lot with issues in Africa when it comes to business, it's like there's a boss or like a leader, and they're the only person that gets engaged. And then everyone has to follow the leader. And everyone, no, you have to create an environment where everyone feels like they're a part of the conversation, where they're contributing as well. And everyone understands, this is what you're doing, this is what I'm doing. And everyone at the same time hears it. So the communication isn't going piecemeal through a variety of people, because then they can frame it in the way that they want. You know what I mean?
You know, I think that's very interesting. On a daily basis, I encounter people who ask questions about doing business in Africa. And sort of the advice that you've given is something that should be in an article. It should be in a book, something, because this is information that you don't get, you don't understand until you're actually staying and working in these conditions. And now we're going to move on a little bit into the getting to know you section, just because I think it's important to understand the person behind the business. It's great to know and learn about your success, but I also want to figure out what makes you tick. So what fires you up in the morning? What's your morning routine, and why is that routine so important for you?
I like long walks on the beach. No, just kidding. coffee fires me up in the morning. I am addicted to fair trade Ethiopian coffee. So if any of the bandits out there have a coffee company, send it my way. Honestly, in the morning, I've been trying to practice this, which I haven't, but I think it is really important, is not jumping into work immediately. Because when you're an entrepreneur, it's really funny. I think that we romanticize what it is to be an entrepreneur. Everyone's like, oh, you wake up when you want to. You take vacation when you want to. You don't have a boss. Like, you just do you. It's not like that at all, at least not from my experience. And so in the past, it's been really challenging to turn off work because there's always so much work to be done. There's never enough time in the day. You know, you're trying to hit targets, you're trying to achieve results. And so you literally, if we didn't have to sleep, I'm sure I would be working 24 hours a day. And so what I tried to practice, and I just, you know, this is recent, is, and I really advise this, is when you wake up in the morning, don't go into work right away. Don't go into work mode. Really trying to utilize, at least if you can, the first 30 minutes of your day to just relax, meditate, whatever it is, prayer, devotional, whatever is your thing. For me, it's my devotional. And I try to just slowly ease into my day and not immediately jump into work. I think that's really important to help set a tone for the day and start your day off with calm. Because when you open up that email box, there's you never know what you're going to find. You just never know what you're going to find. And like I said, I really enjoy my cup of coffee in the morning.
I think that's really good advice. We can see it's almost like every entrepreneur has read from the same book. It's being relaxed before you enter the day. You have to do something that calms you. For Rahama, it's reading her devotions. So whatever your thing is, make sure that your mind is in the right place. Jumping into work, you get burned out very quickly. And sort of, I'm sure you might agree, your productivity sort of declines as the day goes on. And so being an entrepreneur, a big part of it is being able to generate revenue for yourself. So can you share a few ways that you generate income for yourself?
Well, it's primarily through our retail channels. And so in the end of 2012 was when we first got into Whole Foods Market in 7 stores. And now we're in 123 Whole Foods Markets and independent stores along the East Coast. And so that has been our primary revenue generator, as well as our e-commerce platform is another revenue generator. And recently, we're really trying to think out of the box around getting our products to individuals who might not be aware of it. And so doing like an independent sales model where we work with a network of individuals who sell directly to their consumer base or to the people that they know, to their network. And we've done it in very small kind of test environments where a couple of people have tried it. And we've actually seen it is possibly a pretty successful model if you find the right people. For the bandits out there, being able to generate revenue and sustain your business is really closely tied with understanding who your consumer is, understanding what differentiates you in the marketplace, and being able to tap into that consumer base. It can be an ongoing challenge because particularly when you look at a very crowded market or a consumer who has a plethora of options and you don't have a lot of time to like catch their attention. And for us, it has been an ongoing process of looking at the market, looking at how other people market, but not, you know, for me, I don't place too much emphasis on competitors, even though people are always like, oh, who are your competitors? Who competes? Because here's, you can think about your competitors all day long. It's better to think about your business, you know? And so utilizing social media, you know, to get our brand out there, being able to do events and partner with other groups. These are all sorts of things that you can do to test your market. You can do to see how you have to adjust and reposition. I also think that people think that there's this like magic answer where you all of a sudden everything is working perfectly. It's never going to be like that. And you have to be able to be flexible and you have to be able to understand that there are, you'll be required to adjust and adapt. I'll give an example because I want to be clear. For example, our packaging. When we first launched in Whole Foods, I went through a very painful process of finding a designer to update our packaging, you know, to make it pop off shelf, et cetera, et cetera. Now, as we're in more retail outlets and we're thinking about, well, how can we get more reorders? You know, we're in the stores, but how can we improve our turn rate? And so working with a former marketing executive at Whole Foods, one of the things they said was, well, you need to adjust your packaging so you can pop off shelf compared to your competitors or compared to whoever's on shelf. And so it's like, okay, now we are going through this process of really looking at how to redo our packaging. And so that's just an example of how you might think that you have the solution or you've provided a solution, but you may have to adapt it based on what you're seeing in the marketplace. I don't know if that makes sense. Yeah.
No, I think that's really great advice. Is oftentimes we think there's this magic formula that says A plus B equals success, you know, but it's never really like that. And it's like you're always having to adjust to a lot of chaos, actually. That's how it is. So, like, as we move forward in this interview, I want to ask, entrepreneurs always try to make things seem like they're amazing and rosy. And I think it's just the personality and the passion of your business that sort of exudes that sort of confidence. But I want to ask, what has been one of the most challenging moments throughout building your business? A moment that you felt defeated and you didn't know if you could have gone on or not. Can you take us to that moment? Explain it to us.
Initially, when I started getting orders into Whole Foods, I was still self-funding and bootstrapping. So it was a few months, as I told you, there was like probably a 10-month period where it was just still me and we were getting, you know, marginal distribution. And I had transitioned to a new contract manufacturer to do my packaging. And we had a big marketing event with Whole Foods region. And, you know, they were supposed to deliver by a certain date and they did not deliver. And I will never forget. I'm in Washington, D.C. and I'm frantically, you know, I'm walking from the metro to my house and it's about maybe like 6 o'clock. So it's getting to like dusk and it was in the summertime. And I'm on the phone and I'm trying to get like what's going on. Why aren't the products where they're supposed to be? And it was so stressful because the financial stress as well as trying to meet this deadline. And, you know, like you said, everything has to look rosy and fresh on the outside while there's like you're crumbling. Everything feels like it's crumbling. And I got off the phone and I just lost it. And here I am, like, walking, and I'm, like, sobbing because I really felt like my world was over. I was like, Whole Foods is going to kick us out. We missed the deadline. You know, and it was a very traumatic experience. And it was one of those moments where I was just like, you know, I had already paid this person, and their company did not hit a very important deadline. I mean, ultimately it was resolved, you know, we weren't kicked out. But it was one of those moments where, yeah, I had to look all put together on the outside, but it was not put together on the inside.
Wow. That seems to be a common thing, is dealing with people who don't necessarily deliver when they're supposed to. So as an entrepreneur, I'm sure, especially working in the retail side of things, you experience that more often than the average entrepreneur. So how do you deal with that on a daily basis? How do you not sort of just shrivel up? I mean, how do you continue to press on?
Well, now I have plan A, plan B, plan C, plan D. If I can give any advice, I double, triple, quadruple check everything on a regular basis because in the past, I've been burned on so many different occasions that I always need to make sure I have a backup plan. And I really advise this. Don't put all your eggs in one basket. And in my particular space, of course, retail, meeting deadlines, doing production schedules, like all of that is really important because you'll miss orders. If you can't deliver, you'll absolutely miss orders. And so that's kind of my management approach is I constantly check in. I don't enjoy micromanaging. It's not my strength at all. I just think that if you are a professional, you'll provide good quality work without being micromanaged, without being reminded, but you know, now I have to always, you know, if there is an upcoming deadline, I'll check 2 weeks out or, you know, just like constantly staying on top of people. Cause I think the error in the situation I described was I was like, oh, this person, they know what they're doing. They know the deadline. It's going to happen. And now I'm constantly having to keep on top of people. So that's the management side. But in terms of the emotional side, because it hits you hard, both emotionally and psychologically. And I think for me, that's why it's so important to develop a practice where I am doing my devotionals or, you know, staying encouraged, having work-life balance to the best of my ability, even though I regularly fail on that. But I think that that's really key because at the end of the day, if you're not healthy, if if you're crumbling while everything around you is crumbling, it's one disaster after another. And so really trying to maintain that balance. Sometimes I do it very well, sometimes I don't. And I think that there's a need to be kind to yourself as much as possible, because sometimes you can get into this like, oh, woe is me, you know, and really, I was telling one of my team members, Elizabeth, that sometimes when I've had a really bad day, I have to look at either pictures from the cooperatives or the videos. And then I remember, get it together. You know, they're going through a lot more than you are. And that whatever it is, whether it's a picture of someone or whether, you know, you had talked a little bit about the importance of Africans creating businesses that achieve impact. And I think that if you are doing business, not only in Africa, but anywhere, you have to create businesses that are positively impacting people. Because what is a business? At the end of the day, a business is providing a solution to a problem. You know, whether it's, you know, the iPhone or whatever it is, you're providing a solution. Because there are so many challenges and issues that we see and that we experience, either it's going to be a positive impact or a negative impact. So choose positive. And so in order to stay grounded in that idea, you really have to have a passion for it. And it has to be something that you love. Because if not, you'll quit. You know, I told you how many years it took before things really started moving in the right direction. Every level you get to is going to be a new set of challenges. It's like you take off one training wheel, you know, and then you have to add another. You know what I mean? It's just like whether with each phase, with each stage, and it really has to be something that you love. And you have to remind yourself why you love that when you have those tough days.
You know, I think it's good that you mentioned that because it's important to know what you're getting yourself into. If you have this nonchalant attitude about your business and you're going into it, looking at it as a retirement plan, that's really sort of the worst way to approach a business, because when you hit the first or second hurdle, you won't be able to sustain, because money should never be the reason you're starting a business. And like you said, you're always figuring out where you can add value and how you can create a solution to a problem. Money is it's not the end goal. It shouldn't be the end goal for an entrepreneur. And I think that's something we see over and over again. And one thing is you talked about how you have to sort of micromanage. It's not necessarily your strength, but you still have to do it. How do you stay organized and on top of things if there are a lot of people that you have to sort of keep track of?
I try to use calendars as much as possible and keep putting everything on a calendar with reminders. That has been really useful for me. I try to communicate things in terms of priorities and deadlines. We do weekly team meetings at Shailene where everyone who is involved in large or even small projects, but on a regular basis, we all jump on a line and meet and talk and discuss. And so that, I believe, has been helpful, not only for like staying on top of tasks, but also just for team engagement. I have one-on-ones with individuals as much as I can, I should say. And that's to just check in with them. How are things going? What's working? What's not working? And I think that oftentimes I do feel like I'm a counselor or psychologist, you know? And people don't tell you that when you're managing people. But it's true. You have to be concerned about how people are feeling about their work. You have to be concerned about if they're enjoying what they're doing, if something is working or not working, and then figure out how to problem solve. It's a combination of problem solving and troubleshooting. I always look at an issue and say, how can this go wrong? And if it does go wrong, how can I in advance prevent it from going wrong? And I think that that's what I spend a lot of my time doing. I also think that it's important to build in fun. And this is something that, you know, we're working on at Shayaline. No one told me how challenging it would be to build culture in a company. And I think in terms of like retention and building teams and growing teams, that culture part and really defining that and understanding how to cultivate that is the difference between, you know, running a floundering company and running a brand that can really grow and scale.
That's great. You actually answered most of the questions that I had, and I think it was a more poetic way than I actually intended. So I appreciate that. And so you were getting into sort of the fun side of being an entrepreneur, because I don't want to make it seem like it's all this negative stuff. And I know you would probably say, regardless of all of the challenges you've spoken of, I'm sure you would say that it's still mostly a great experience. And so I want you to take us to a moment where you look back and you're like, you know what, that was sort of the defining moment as an entrepreneur.
Well, I don't know if there's one defining moment. I think there have been many absolutely mind-blowing things that I could have never predicted. I mean, you create your business plan, you create your strategy, you put up your goals, and some things you just don't achieve, or you haven't yet achieved it within the timeline that you think. And then other things you're like, I don't have any idea how this happened. And I think that a couple of those moments was when we did the Smithsonian Folklife Festival. It was in 2011 with the Peace Corps, the National Peace Corps Association. And the Peace Corps, they celebrated the 50th anniversary of Peace Corps. And we had shea producers on the National Mall in Washington, D.C., making shea butter and teaching people from all around the world where this product comes from, how it's contributing to their lives. And that was a really powerful moment, because it really encapsulated what I wanted to do with Shayaline, which was give visibility to these women and also give them a voice within the marketplace. Again, when two shea producers came and we did the speaking tour with Whole Foods Market and, you know, went to 26 different Whole Foods locations, and they were able to meet with buyers and meet with customers. Those were very powerful moments for me, going through my first round of private equity funding with absolutely no financial background and really navigating that, you know, experience. It was a roller coaster. It wasn't easy, but being able to get through that. And I think, I mean, most recently, being part of President Obama's advisory council on doing business in Africa and getting a chance to travel to Nigeria and Rwanda on Air Force Two. Who does that? I mean, that was never part of my strategic plan. And it's just an example of, you never know where your dream, passion, idea will take you. So you owe it to yourself to try. And I can 100% say, regardless of where Shayaline goes and what direction we end up in, I tried. I can say that, you know. And I think a lot of times people don't try because they're afraid of failure. And I think that the opportunity to do something that you really believe in and something that you love is, you can't even compare it to this idea of failure. Because in the trying, already you succeeded. And I know that sounds very like, you know, warm and fuzzy, but really it is. And you don't know how you'll grow as a human being, as a person. I think that the lessons I've learned being an entrepreneur, I could not have learned anywhere else, or learned within any other job description at all. Because it tests you on emotional, psychological, physical, everything. It's like your whole being is tested. And I think that, you know, you can't create these case studies. You live them. And I challenge everyone to really live their life where they feel like they're contributing something that is of them, and they're making an impact in something that's important to them.
Wow, I think that nothing else needs to be said. I think that was a perfect segue into the rapid fire right now. God, yeah. Are you ready?
I'm not ready.
Well, it's happening anyways. Yeah.
Okay. Your choice.
Yeah. So what was stopping you initially from taking that step to become an entrepreneur?
Nothing stopped me. I started right out of Peace Corps in my early 20s with no business experience.
Great, great. And at what point did you stop looking at your business as a project and more as an actual business?
Oh, that's a good question. Probably when we did the first event where the women came over, and seeing the dynamic of them with consumers and people, and seeing how, and we sold a lot of product too. And so that was like, I was like, whoa, we really can do this. So I think that was the first moment where I realized this isn't just this thing that I'm doing. Like, we're building something that's here to stay.
And what quality do you have as an entrepreneur that most contributes to your success?
I refuse to give up. There have been so many times where I've been knocked down. I just get back up. I was telling someone the other day how I am rejected on a consistent basis all the time. Even when you reach a certain level, you still face rejection. People's favorite word to an entrepreneur is no. At this point, I mean, it took me 3 times to get into Whole Foods. It wasn't here's my product. All right, come on in. No, it wasn't like that at all. And I just refused to give up. And I think that that's one thing that's always been my personality, though, ever since I was little. So I just refuse to give up. And if I think about it, if I had given up in year 3, I wouldn't have achieved anything in year 6. If I gave up in year 7, I wouldn't have achieved anything in year 10. You know what I mean? You just have to keep going. And I think that that's one thing. If I'm not skilled at anything else, I can get knocked down and I will consistently get back up.
And looking back on those 3 times that you got rejected, or 2 times that you got rejected from Whole Foods, what did you change? How was your approach different? And how did you end up actually getting in there?
The thing about getting knocked down, but then getting back up, is learning and really figuring out, well, why was I knocked down? And one of the things that I constantly pray for is the lesson. I really want to learn. I just don't want to go through something difficult and not learn something. I need to learn so I can figure out what to do next time. And I had to do everything from adjusting my packaging. I had to go to another region to pitch. And I remember during those initial no's, and I was getting rejected left and right, I was disappointed. You know, getting a no isn't easy. But then I asked myself, have I asked every single buyer at every single store, every single location? And until I do that, I haven't asked anyone at all. And I think that really putting it into context and realizing this person said no to me, but will another person say no? And if that person says no, will another person say no? And so initially I pitched here in the Mid-Atlantic region, but then I had to go to another region to pitch. And so my advice to bandits is that, you know, don't put yourself in a box or think that just because this person said no, everyone else will say no.
Wow, that's really great advice. I actually broke protocol there, but I was just very actually curious on learning how you were able to push past the no's until you finally got a yes. And So sort of conversely, what quality do you wish to improve on most as an entrepreneur?
The quality that I've struggled with the most and continue to is the financial part, because I don't have a financial brain to save my life. I've learned when I started Shayalene, I didn't know what a profit and loss statement was. I didn't know what a balance sheet was. I didn't know what a cash flow statement was. And so these are all things you have to have some level of comfort if you're going to run a business. Even if someone else, like your accountant, is managing it or a bookkeeper, you still have to understand certain concepts. So that was one of the biggest challenges for me. And I utilized free programs like the SCORE program, which is an program that the Small Business Administration will assign you to a former business executive, and they will help you, whether it's teaching you something or going through your plans. So that was really helpful for me to understand everything from like how to calculate my profit margins, my cost of goods, all of that. And so that's an area that everyone, understand the financial part before you do anything else.
And what's the best advice you ever received, and who is it from?
Oh, wow. I've received so much good advice from so many people. I've received a lot of advice from different people just around faith and like the importance of cultivating and having faith in my life. And this is both from my reverend at the church that I attend, and just mentors and individuals who are older than me who have given me advice and who've experienced a lot of things and can say, just because you're dealing with this problem now doesn't mean this problem will exist forever. And I think that really having faith and being patient is a skill that all entrepreneurs need to have, or an awareness that you need to have. And I think that it's just this idea that, you know, the issues and challenges of this present moment are not meant to destroy your idea, bring you down, or, you know, you're supposed to learn. There's something in this moment. And I think that that has been advice that I've carried with me, and I always have to come back to when things aren't working out.
Wow, I think that's definitely really powerful, is understanding that whatever situation you're going through, it's a learning experience. Don't look at it as a challenge. Look at it as a learning experience. And what advice would you give to a young you just starting out 10 years ago, however long ago?
Calm down. No. okay, yeah. My younger self, I would have told, take some time to think through your planning and think through your ideas. I didn't start a business plan until like 3-4 years in. I was just roaring to go. I was like, I have this idea. One thing I was doing was telling everyone about my idea. I don't care if you were at the bus stop, the metro station, church, at an event, networking event or no networking event. And I would just meet a bunch of people, because I'd just be like, chatting away, which was really good, because I actually met a lot of really diverse people who were initially my supporters. But I definitely would have advised myself to plan more and think through my idea more. I'm the type of person who has an idea and I just run with it, and then whatever happens, happens. I would have said, think a little bit about the process a little bit more. Yeah.
that's definitely good advice. I think I've run into the situation where I have an idea and I just started immediately, and a few months down the road I'm just like, you know, if I planned a little bit, I could have figured out that this was going to happen. Yeah. And what internet resource or application do you use that you couldn't live without?
Google. Because that's how I built my company. I literally would just like put in a question. I'd be like, how do I get caps? How do I get jars? And whatever search engine, whatever came up in the search, I would then literally spend hours going through each one, looking at their minimums, looking at where to get samples. Because you have to keep in mind, I had no business experience or a beauty background or any relationships in any of these sectors. And so I had to just figure it all out. And that's one of the resources that I use. And I would research reports. I would research ingredients. You know, what were the benefits here? And that's really how I started coming up with my own ingredient profiles, contract packagers, chemists, labs, all of that. Because I had nothing. So that's why I say Google, even though you're you're giving me a little. Today, I use Uber a lot. Okay. I do. Yeah. They take all my money, Uber and Lyft.
I think Uber, I'm probably one of the people, you and I are keeping Uber open. And finally, for the to close out the rapid fire round, do you feel like you've made it?
Ooh, I feel like I've made progress. And I'm trying to be better at fully experiencing where I am versus, okay, I've achieved this, on to the next thing, which I think a lot of entrepreneurs do. And really like, oh my gosh, why do I have an office on H Street? How am I in Whole Foods Market? How did I get private equity funding? And really, so I feel like I've made progress. If you looked at where I was four years ago or 5 years ago or, 10 years ago. And honestly, I don't ever want to feel like I made it, because I think that gives the suggestion that there's no more opportunity. That I've kind of hit my maximum potential. And I don't think as human beings, we ever do. There's always something new to learn. There's always a new challenge. I mean, eventually, I want Shayaleen to be completely sustainable without me being the CEO, maybe me being a spokesperson. But I really want to continue being a leader on this issues of women and economic empowerment, maybe not just in the continent, maybe globally. You know what I mean? I eventually want to teach people. I want to be a professor and teach people about creating sustainable business models that are making true positive impact on the lives of people around the world. You know what I mean? So I don't ever want to feel like, oh, I made it. Let me take my shoes off and, drive around and be fancy. I don't think that's not why I'm an entrepreneur. I want to change the world. I want to be able to contribute beyond what my own understanding of what making it is,
I think that's a perfect way to close out the rapid fire round. I think there are a lot of people listening who share that same passion that you have. And I mean, what sort of opportunities can you offer for mentorship or internship opportunities for people who have listened to this podcast and really identify with you?
Well, I would love any bandit to reach out to me. I actually get quite a few people who cold call or, cold email me when they're starting their companies or if they have a question. And I love giving back in that way. We love having interns. So if you're interested in interning with us, we have everything from marketing, social media, production. We can even craft something that's in the interest of a student and what they're trying to accomplish. Last year, we actually had a young African leaders fellow working out of our office for 6 weeks. We have a brick and mortar, so you can stop in if you're in the DC area. We love it when people visit us. And I'm of the mindset that, if one of us is successful, we're all successful. So meaning, I think that too often, particularly in our community, we don't reach back and help the next generation. And so you have people from generations trying to figure it out. I don't ever want, in this day and age, we shouldn't still just be trying to figure it out. If someone is trying to build a company, build a beauty business, build a brand, there are enough people in our community who can help each other. And so that's my perspective. If I can give you, someone emailed me from Ghana, who is doing a snack business. And so they want to bring healthy snacks from Ghana to the U.S. but they didn't have any information on import, export. They didn't have any information on who could package it. They didn't, you know, it's a completely different industry, but there are a lot of similarities. Trucking the product, getting the product, getting distributors. So I just sent them everything that I had. And I was like, if you need help, let me know. I made some introductions. Anyone can do that. If you don't have time doing that for your community, there's something wrong. And I think that there's too many of our leaders who are more concerned with being leaders versus really changing the community. And I think part of changing our community is sharing best practices, sharing knowledge, sharing contacts, and giving advice in our experience as much as we can.
And I think that's sort of indicative of how we started this podcast, was talking about this whole idea of creative capitalism, is building your business to give back. Because at the end of the day, you can't take any of this money. You can't take any of these possessions with you. And what is one book that you would recommend for the bandits?
So I just recently finished reading David and Goliath by Malcolm Gladwell. And it was a book that talked about how we tend to think that these large companies that have been in existence for a really long time, or these very successful big ideas, are in a sense the only way to go. Like, if you compare a big company versus a little company, you know, you would assume the big company would excel and be more successful. But how, in very certain instances and examples, how the little person, the little guy, was able to excel, or in some cases, bring down the Goliath. And it really spoke to me, because sometimes we always put our bets on the big, successful, flashy, you know, person, and not necessarily the little person or an individual or an idea that doesn't have as much traction. So it was really encouraging and inspiring to me. So I really enjoyed that book.
And for any of the bandits listening, if you want to see David and Goliath that Rahama has recommended to us, you can check out the specific page that we're putting up for her. And as we sort of say goodbye, can you sort of give the bandits a piece of advice on starting their business? You know, a lot of people are afraid. So what advice would you give them?
Well, don't be afraid and start today. Stop waiting for perfect. Stop saying to yourself, oh, I'll wait until I get my MBA. Oh, I'll wait until I've raised a lot of money. Oh, I'll wait until this. Oh, I'll wait until that. Because if you keep waiting, you'll realize a year has gone by, 2 years has gone by, 10 years have gone by, and you haven't started. And so I think that my advice will be, start today. There's really no reason not to. And even if it's starting very small, you have to start somewhere. And so, you know, don't be afraid. And start. And in that starting, it's kind of like you're revving up a motor. And you know what I mean? It's like, you got to start. And then as you start moving in the direction of your purpose, your idea, your dream, you realize that things start opening up to you. It's not going to be easy. But I don't know anything in life that's easy. I mean, after elementary school, I kind of feel like everything went downhill. Or is it just me? And I feel like we live in a society where we are sold this idea of easy. Yet nothing is easy. So why not at least enjoy this very difficult world that we have, doing something that you believe in and something that you love? So start today.
Very wise words. That's inspiring me to go out and start whatever I want to right now. And how can the bandits connect with you via Twitter, your website, email address? Can you share those links with us?
Yes, I can. So my Twitter is Rahama2Right. We also have the Shayaline Twitter page. We have the Shayaline Instagram page and Facebook page, and they're all Shayaline. And I can share my email address, which is rwright@shayaline.com. And so I also have a Periscope that's at Rahama2Right. And so those are all various ways to get in touch with me.
Great. I really appreciate this. And there's a final question. It's a bit of a difficult question, so you can take some time if you need to answer it. But you are tasked with building the greatest business the world has ever seen. You can bring on any two people, living or dead. With you taking the lead, who would you bring on and what would you do?
Ooh, that's a really hard question. Any two people, living or dead? Ha. Huh. Wow. This is a really tough one. I would like Harriet Tubman, because she was ride or die. When I hear her story of going back into enslaved states and bringing her community members to freedom, I can't even imagine, at the risk of her own life. I feel like that's a level of self-sacrifice and commitment to the right thing, and faith in her community that you rarely see. And I think that those are all attributes of a very powerful and successful business leader. I can only imagine if she lived today with that same level of ethic, same level of value. Can you imagine? Look at what amazing things she did back then. So for me, I'm every time I hear her story, I'm just so, it just astonishes me. It astonishes me. So I think I would want her on my team. The second person, I feel like I need more time to think. I mean, she came immediately in my mind. It's kind of a tie between Madam C.J. Walker, because she was the first millionaire, Black woman millionaire, and she was in the industry that I'm in, and so beauty. Yeah. And so it would be interesting to have someone like her who was in this industry and was very successful in a time where it was very hard to be successful. And I gotta throw in my girl Oprah. I mean, I don't need to say anything else.
Yeah, so I'll let you get away with adding that extra one, but that's the dream team with Rahama taking the lead. Rahama, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure. This is the most fun I've had all week.
This is the Knowledge Bandits podcast. We want to thank you for joining us today. Don't forget to subscribe on iTunes, Overcast, or Stitcher. You can also follow Knowledge Bandits on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And as always, Bandits, stay inspired.